session number 16782, reel 3.
My recollections of this early period, as I say, the second or third mission that I'd flown, it was late in the day. It was dusk. The sun was setting. Dramatic sort of landscape, and suddenly it was apparent that there was a lot going on. There were enemy aircraft around. It wasn't quite apparent where they were at that stage, but they were being called by the direction teams in the ships, that they had indications that an attack was coming in. And quite suddenly everything started happening. I remember seeing another pair of Sea Harriers coming down my left-hand side, 2 or 3 miles away. Then it was apparent that they were going for an enemy target. And I remember seeing over my left shoulder an aircraft hit and explode, and it was, I think this was the first time I'd actually seen an aircraft explode at quite short range to me. I mean, it was a mile or so away from me, and it was sort of highlighted in the setting sun. I mean, it was a very dramatic picture in itself, both dramatic and horrific. In the event, there were several aircraft shot down at that stage, and once it was all over, I mean, it was this sort of thing is all over very quickly. Then we all went back and landed on board, and that was another couple of aircraft kills. And as I said, thankfully we were not losing aircraft ourselves. Subsequent operations, they ranged really from some in really extremely bad weather. I mean, another thing that sticks in my mind was a day or so later was, and we knew that one of the Air Force Harriers had been lost, and the pilot had parachuted down and was thought to be on the Falklands. We weren't quite sure where he was. And over the radio, I remember hearing somebody using the yesterday's call sign, which seemed strange. We realized actually that this was the chap who had been shot down the day before, calling on his emergency radio. Now, at the time, there was a very, very thick cloud. The weather was extremely poor. And we were trying to let down. There were enemy aircraft known to be around, and I remember letting down through holes in the cloud, trying to get down to low level, trying to get in behind where we thought the Argentine Skyhawk aircraft would be, and eventually, hurtling through a space in the between the ground and the cloud, probably less than 100 feet thick, because it was really very bad weather. And the chap who had been shot down, I remember him saying to me after the event that he'd heard aircraft. He'd gone out. He'd been hiding in an Argentine hut, and he'd gone out to see what was going on, and he'd been confronted by an Argentine aircraft flying past. At very low level, very fast, and then within a few seconds later by a Harrier aircraft chasing it. In fact, the Harrier aircraft was myself, but we never did actually get onto the Argentine aircraft. But again, that little sort of is an indication. I mean, that was bad weather operations in poor visibility in low cloud. That was, as I say, another little thing that stuck in my mind. Another event that is imprinted indelibly in my mind is the time when the ships were were actually the landing ship logistics, the LSLs, were attacked in Fitzroy and set alight, and there was a huge loss of life, and a lot of people burnt. And we heard that something was happening, and I remember arriving on the scene there and providing combat air patrol over the top of these two ships and seeing the sort of horrific situation of ships having been set alight, glowing red in the middle. I mean, it was a most awful sight from looking down on it from above, and difficult to imagine quite the scene ashore. I mean, there was lots of publicity after that, after the event, and we had no idea at that stage just how bad the scene was, although one could imagine that that the ships that had been hit and were set alight was going to be a huge problem for those. But the rest of the operations, really, my recollections were of a lot of time waiting, and inevitably in any war a lot of time is spent waiting for something to happen. We spent a lot of time on alert, on deck, deck alert, waiting in the aircraft, ready to launch should something happen. And then, of course, there were the lengthy transits where you were flying in relative safety into the air patrol area. Then there was a period in the CAP area where you were working at a very high level and waiting for something to happen, trying to follow any sort of indication that there were enemy aircraft around. And then, of course, there was a period of transit back and the landing back on board the ship. Generally speaking, that period of coming back and landing was no problem, except, as I say, sometimes the weather was bad. But we were doing, I think, the most number of missions in a day I flew was four. Generally, we were flying twice or three times a day, although there were periods of total inactivity. And this general pattern of events continued. The last time I actually flew was 4 days, as it happened, before the end of the war, when I was invited ordered to go ashore. We had some problems with the tasking of the attack missions, particularly the tasking of the Royal Air Force aircraft and arrangements. And the reason that I was invited to go ashore was because I had spent an appointment a couple of years or so with the Royal Marines, actually running their aviation and air tasking of attack aircraft in particular. And I had done in only 3 or 4 years before the Falklands. So of the naval people that were down there, I was in a fairly good position to probably to find out what was wrong and maybe do something about it. So much to my surprise, I was sent ashore. The other reason I think that I was chosen was that the end was, I think, seen to be in sight, albeit it was 4 days to go, but people's thoughts, staff thoughts, strategic planning was already thinking towards what was going to happen after the war, how we were essentially going to keep the peace. And I had been earmarked to actually come back as early as possible back to UK to reform a squadron and go down again in the period immediately after the war was over in a new carrier, in the Illustrious, that had been brought forward out of her build, with a squadron to go and provide the air defence for the area in that immediate aftermath. And so I was inserted actually in a sort of clandestine operation. I went for a briefing from Invincible. I went for a briefing in Hermes. Then I went in a very lengthy, about nearly a 2 hour helicopter flight in pitch darkness in a gale, and was lowered on the end of a wire onto the after end of a LSL, Landing Ship Logistic, which was doing a sort of clandestine insertion into San Carlos water. To my huge relief, having been dangling on the end of this wire, found my feet on the deck, and somebody actually came out to me and said my name, and my relief was just enormous at that stage. Anyway, I spent about 12 hours in this ship, and we arrived in San Carlos in thick fog at about, well, just as dawn was breaking, so about 7 o'clock in the morning their time. As I said earlier, this was about 10 o'clock or 10:30 or so in the time that we were working in the fleet. But as the fog slowly cleared, it was a very, very dramatic sight, because all around us were warships, and all around us was activity. And I went from the LSL over to the one of the bigger amphibious ships, over to the Fearless, in a small boat. And this extraordinary sort of contrast of having been in aircraft and at sea, out at sea, in the greyness and the sort of blackness of wartime, seeing everything from the air. Suddenly there was this enormous contrast with the really very, very beautiful surroundings with the hills of San Carlos, but warships all around, and this fearsome activity that was going on, flat calm, sun shining, small boat plying between two ships. That really, really stuck in my mind. A few minutes tranquil, and then into the very busy atmosphere of the amphibious ships. And my task was actually to sort out a problem of air tasking. In the course of that, I spent a while in the Fearless. I went up to in a helicopter up to the side of Mount Kent, where the 3 Brigade was dug in. A lot of my old contemporaries in the Royal Marines, because 3 Brigade was essentially the nucleus of the 3 Commando Brigade Royal Marines that I'd worked with. So all the people that I'd worked with were all there, many of them doing the same sort of job. And then I went down in that same day in another helicopter down to Fitzroy and Bluff Cove, and saw the remnants of 5 Brigade that were there sorting themselves out after their attack. As an aside, I mean, my flight in the helicopter I have always found interesting afterwards. The Gazelle helicopter, they'd taken all the seats out of the back of the helicopter so you could put more things or people into it. So I was sitting on just the floor of this helicopter holding on. And with my own flying helmet on, I'd managed to plug myself into the intercom system. And I said to the sergeant pilot, by way of conversation, there was a huge strip of masking tape around the front canopy of the aircraft, and I made some comment about why the aircraft was held together with masking tape, and he said to me, oh, they'd had a wire strike the previous day. Now, a wire strike to an aviator generally means that an aircraft has flown into high-tension cables of one sort or another. It struck me that actually, having thought about this for a few moments, that actually there weren't any high-tension wires in the Falklands. I said, made some comment to this effect, and he said, oh, they'd hit the, while flying at low level, they'd hit the barbed wire of a fence, which gave some indication of the sort of height that they must have been flying at. The next recollection was, and it was the nearest I've ever seen to properly being shot at. I mean, I suppose we had been shot at in the air-to-air war, but you don't actually see bullets when you're flying a fighter aircraft. You don't actually see tracer coming towards you, and unless it's actually going to hit you, probably. It was the first time in my life that I'd actually seen tracer being fired at me in an aircraft. And they were actually firing at this helicopter, and we were flying at about 2 feet above the ground at high speed, trying to sort of hide in ditches and things as we made our way down. That recollection was is still very firmly imprinted in my mind. We landed at Fitzroy on a very cold morning, frost all around, brilliant sunshine. And I remember making my way from where we'd landed. I wanted to go up to the brigade headquarters to talk with the staff there, and I found a Falkland Islander dressed in a boiler suit, of all things, rodding his drain. He had a block drain, and he had a set of rods and a pusher on the end of it, and he was doing something as mundane as rodding a drain. And I had to go up to him and say, you know, I had to speak to him, because he was the first Falkland Islander that I'd ever met, and I wanted just to be able to say to myself that I'd spoken to somebody. He looked very perplexed at this and couldn't understand why on earth somebody wanted just to talk with him for the sake of it. But in the event, I went in and had breakfast with him. In my time, it was past lunchtime at this stage of the day, but as I've said, the time difference was such that it was his breakfast time. So I went in and had a cup of tea and a huge wad of thick bread and marmalade, and spent 10 or 15 minutes there, which was a bit of light relief, really, in what was really a very horrific day. And at the end of which I then went in another helicopter back to the Fearless, and the spent the next day or so, in fact the next 24 hours, aboard Fearless, taking a part in the tasking of the attack missions. Now this was really the last 24 hours of the war. We knew things were building up to a climax. I mean, things generally had gone quite well for the British forces. The advance of the ground forces out of San Carlos area had been progressive. There'd been the Battle of Goose Green, there'd been the various other battles, and the general progression had been going according to plan, not without huge dramas and huge losses, very sad losses, but generally the progression was eastward, and by this stage the town of Stanley was coming into sight of the first ground forces. So the final sort of push was planned for the following day, and so I was able to play a very small part in the sort of tasking of aircraft at that stage. And my real final recollection of the actual combat was at a stage where we had planned attack missions against particular targets, and with using very specific weapons against them. And aircraft had been tasked and were actually airborne and coming in. And I was listening on a radio set to the sort of background chatter. And as the aircraft were actually airborne and on their mission, suddenly the a voice came over the net saying that white flags had been seen. And that call was repeated. And I think that was really the time of the surrender. I remember looking at my watch, and I think it was about 3:45 in that afternoon on the 14th of June. That was the, I think, the first indication of actually the surrender. That was the first time that people were talking about white flags, and at that stage we called off the air strike, and there was then a period of some confusion, inevitably, because one little group of people had surrendered, but of course that was not an indication that everybody had surrendered, and of course the actual surrender process took a while to arrange. And didn't, in fact, take place until later that evening. But really, that was the end of the combat phase of the war. And as I've said, to find myself listening on a radio set while that happened, I found quite an exciting period.
When you talk about the tasking of the aircraft, presumably you mean making a decision as to what jobs they should do.
Yes, air tasking is something that needs to be done on an immediate basis. I mean, essentially what happens is that the army or the ground troops decide for whatever reason, I mean, either they have a problem or they have a requirement for wanting air attack on a target. That might be because they're being attacked themselves, or it may be because they have something in their way that they want to attack before they can move forward. But that tasking message inevitably needs to be translated to the air crew in a cockpit with the right weapon, translated into a target to them in the shortest possible time. The tasking is invariably it's real time. It is immediate. The requirement is there, and it's usually a requirement to happen there and then because of the reason. And so what was happening was that the time it took from the initiation of the tasking message to the time that it actually got into the hands of the pilot in the cockpit of the aircraft was just taking far too long, and the battle had moved on, and in some cases the aircraft were actually going to the wrong target being shot at by enemy as a result.
Did you hit any enemy aircraft yourself?
No, in the air-to-air sense, no, I didn't. There wasn't a lack of trying. But in the event, there were no actual aircraft within range. Although we chased aircraft, they were either too far gone or. No, we weren't in the right place. There was a huge element of chance in this whole business. The one thing we lacked in the Falklands was proper airborne early warning. I mean, this was a well-known deficiency in the fleet, and the ability for the fleet to provide airborne radars, we simply didn't have it. We had limited, well, we had radar cover from the ships themselves, obviously, but. The ability of the Royal Naval ships in San Carlos water to provide a warning of air attack at low level inevitably was limited. I mean, radar sets in landlocked areas in with mountains all around is not going to work at low level. And we could have done with an airborne radar set over the Falklands able to detect incoming aircraft. We can now provide that. We have the capability. We put that capability into effect very soon after the Falklands as one of the immediate measures. But it was a great deficiency at the time.
I've interviewed quite a lot of Second World War fighter pilots and bomber pilots, for that matter, who've talked to me about what was perhaps cruelly described in the Second World War as lack of moral fibre. That is, pilots who were shaken by being in air combat and used to do things like saying their aircraft was faulty and couldn't take off as a means of avoiding it. Was there ever any suggestion of that you came across?
This is something that I think I certainly was uppermost in my mind. I think it's something that commanding officers of any body of men in war have right at the front of their minds is how their people are going to behave in high stress situations. I have to say that looking back on it now, there were very, very few surprises to me. The people. And I had the benefit of knowing most of the pilots very well. I didn't know the Royal Air Force pilots, but all the naval pilots I had either had an element or either been involved with their training or I had worked with or whatever, and some of them over a number of years. Those that I thought were going to do well almost invariably did well, and some of them did very, very well. Some of those who perhaps I thought might have been mediocre, average, did better, and almost invariably nobody did did worse. excuse me. There were very, very few surprises to me. Some people inevitably, I suppose, maybe didn't do perhaps as well as they had hoped they might. But overall, this was not the case. I think we did not have a problem with either morale or people suffering from high stress.
If you had shot somebody down, do you think you would have been worried about it now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, although I wasn't involved in shooting people in the air, I did actually have an occasion to shoot at a helicopter on the ground. I, to this day, don't know actually whether we hit anybody or for that matter, the helicopter, although the helicopter was damaged, but there were two of us shooting at it. No, I think, of course, in air-to-air combat, one of the things you don't see is the actual person, quite unlike any ground armed combat, hand-to-hand combat. And so there is an element of detachment, and you tend to think of yourself as fighting the other aircraft. You know, it's a Sea Harrier against a Mirage, as opposed to myself against whoever it is that's inside the Mirage. And I think most people can keep an element of detachment in that. It's easy to say that because I'm not the situation doesn't exist. But I think we were doing a job of work, and that was the requirement at the time. We'd all been well and highly trained to do that. I don't think it worries many of those in the air combat side.